Our speaker is an expert in overcoming adversity. He's England's most capped blind footballer, dual Paralympian, recipient of an honorary doctorate and best-selling author. Not in spite of, but because of his blindness. Please welcome Darren Harris.
Welcome. My name's Keith Valentine. I'm Chief Executive of Fight for Sight and Vision Foundation. Darren, it is an absolute pleasure to have you joining us today. How's life looking to you?
It's great, actually. Yeah, it's RB Awareness Week. So it's a really exciting week for all of us that are connected with the charity and obviously the condition. And, you know, that's what we're going to try and do this week is get more people knowing about what it is that we do.
Fantastic. And the retinoblastoma, particularly of interest to Fight for Sight, we've invested extensively in research around looking for treatments and early detection. So it's a real pleasure to be talking to you as someone that's definitely a role model for me, having seen what you've been up to in the last couple of years. So why don't you tell us about Unblind Your Mind? It sounds like a really exciting business you've got going there.
For me, it was this epiphany where for all of my life up until that point, my focus is on searching for my sight. I'd lost my sight and I wanted it back. And that was that kind of all-encompassing experience and feeling. And then I realized that A, it wasn't going to come back, and B, that life had to continue without it. And so Unblind Your Mind and unblinding yourself, for me, was this idea of removing all the baggage, I suppose, that comes with the label of blindness, you know, the beliefs that people implant in you, that you hear from, you know, the world around you, that being blind is somehow really negative and that your life is going to be worse for it. And therefore, I had to unburden myself and get rid of all that baggage that kind of held me down at that time, and also lots of other blind people. So, yeah, that was it. It was, you know, I'm not going to get my sight back. What I'm going to do is unblind myself, you know.
Yeah, I somebody myself, I've got retinitis pigmentosa, so degenerative disease, just, you know, not as dramatic in one moment, but slow, steady and aggressive over time. And it always sort of was really clear that because of the way that these eye conditions work, we're often describing ourselves and being described in the negative. Mm. And what's missing, and one of the things I think it's really interesting in what you're saying there about unblind your mind, it feels like it's an acceptance of what's possible, not just an acceptance of the sight, but an acceptance that you are, you know, a contributor, a motivator. You know, there are words to describe in the positive, if you like, as well as in the negative. And I wonder if you've got any thoughts about how you kind of make that leap, you know, from.
Yeah, well, you know, in my intro, what I kind of said was about, you know, the things I achieved were ultimately because of my blindness in the end. Now, no one really knows what I would have accomplished had I not lost my sight. No, no, that, you know, life doesn't allow us to plan a parallel universe. But there's no doubt that going to the Paralympics, I wouldn't have been able to do that with sight. And there's no doubt that the things that I've accomplished as a result of that, you know, my England blind football career, all those sorts of things were because I was blind. And so I was able to have this, you know, incredible life, do these amazing things because I'm blind. And I can think back to so many occasions when I've stood at a bus stop or a train station and people have come up to me, you know, well-meaning, of course, but there's this sort of sadness in their voice and this pity in their voice. It's like, oh, you know, life must be awful because, you know, you're blind, sort of thing. And with no knowledge of what I've achieved. So, you know, they see a white stick or they see a guide dog, and then, you know, they see, you know, those symbols of blindness. And then what comes with that is this association of all these other things. Therefore, you know, he must not be able to go out on his own. You know, are you going to have a family, or are you going to have a job, or are you going to have all these other things that people just immediately jump to these conclusions of what your life must be like because they see this initial blindness.
So the Paralympian and the football career, definitely going to come back to that. But so that point you're making there first about what people perceive, as well as the content of what you do with Unblind Your Mind, you're also an entrepreneur in the sense that you're you know, you're running your own business there. So I wonder what that's like, because people, I don't think, expect visually impaired and blind people to be able to do those things. I mean, how do you, I mean, it's probably the less exciting end of what you do, but you've got accountants to manage, I imagine, and you've got, you know, bookings and marketing and all of those sorts of things. How have you, you know, adapted to, you know, to get a grip with that so that it's great for growing your business?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I learned it from, you know, even when I did judo, actually, I did an individual sport, and you realize that even in a quotes individual sport, that you need a team of people around you to help you to flourish, to do whatever it is you want to do. So that was really important. I got good people around me who could help me with some of the technical things, and also some of the bits that, let's be honest, I didn't like doing or wasn't very good at. The pandemic was a prime example of that, because when I speak on stage, there's an AV person, an audio visual person, who sets up all the lighting, sets up all the audio equipment, and you just have to stand on stage and do your thing. And then when we went to this online world during the pandemic, I had to do all of that myself. I had to do all of the tech myself. And it really challenged me, because at one point I remember I was thinking, well, do I need to use lighting? Do I need to use a green screen? And I was trying all these different lights out, and then people would say, oh, the light reflects off your glasses, and then there's a shadow on the wall, and then what the sun does is it moves, doesn't it? You know, so in the morning it's fine, and in the afternoon it's not fine, you know. And there was this all these additional things to think about, and also that the reflection from my glasses as well, you could see what was kind of in front of me. So even though you only think about the stuff that's kind of behind you and what your back wall is and what the camera is kind of looking at, because I wore my glasses and it reflected off my glasses, I also had to think about the other side of the room as well. And so there was all these other things I had to think about, which I'd never thought about before. So I really respect all those tech people that just make the magic happen seamlessly. But yeah, absolutely, running a business is a challenge. I think, you know, most people want a 9-to-5 because it does offer them that security, and they know exactly what they're going to get each month. They know where they're going to be each month. But I think having the life that I've had, and that no day has ever really been the same anyway, that I don't think that's a world that I really wanted to kind of go back to. But I got into speaking by chance, really. I knew nothing about the world of professional speaking. I didn't know you could get paid to speak. And what actually happened was, after London 2012, I went to an event which was organised by the British Olympic Association. I think it was down in Reading, actually, at the Majeski Stadium. And they had all these different companies there who were interested in speaking to athletes who were thinking about coming to the end of their careers. And one of those was the Professional Speaking Association. And I remember talking to Alan Stevens, who I think was president at the time. And he goes, you know, athletes have got some great stories and people will pay you to listen to those. I went, really? So I got this membership for a year, and I just started going and watching other speakers and thinking, gosh, I could never do what they do. You know, they spoke unscripted for an hour, you know, no slides, no notes. My very first talk was in 2008, and it was at my granddad's funeral. And there's a picture of me holding these Braille notes in front of me and sort of reading them as I'm speaking. And so to kind of think back to that point to now, where I can do, you know, an hour presentation with no notes and no slides, is, it's amazing. But that's because there's a process to being good at everything you do.
And I guess, you know, given that you were, you know, successful as a in an individual sport and a team sport, that there will have been, you know, I guess, method in that you can find other ways of applying in life. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your impressive sporting career, Darren, and how it shaped your life.
You know, sport was, I know I say it all the time that we sell sport really badly in this country, because most people do sport for one of three reasons. They either do it to get fit, to lose weight, or to get big muscles. And it's just so much more than that. And when I'm in schools, I sometimes wonder whether I should ever say this, but I tell them that, you know, sport and football in particular is the best teacher I ever had, because it taught me everything that you can think about that's important in life in terms of how to win and how to lose, that mental control. How do you keep positive thoughts, you know, when you're in a difficult situation? How do you regulate your emotions, you know, when decisions go against you? And also just dealing with people, because, you know, you get put in these unusual situations. You know, when we go to tournaments, you're sharing a room, hopefully with someone you get on with, but undoubtedly you're going to be in an environment where you don't get on with everybody in your team, or maybe you're competing for a place against someone else in that team. So those kind of individual rivalries, you know, and that's a real challenge for a lot of people. So it's people think about sport in terms of the physical elements and the sort of the technical elements, but really the psychological and the social factors of what I think really separate the very best players from the average players. And so sport taught me that from a very early age. And at first I did it just because I enjoyed it. You know, I was that kid at school who played football, you know, before school started. I played at break time, lunchtime, after school. You know, I always remember one particular winter when it was snowing and you know, the pitch was covered in snow, and we found some shovels and we were just scraping all the snow off the pitch so we could play, because that's what we wanted to do. And you know, it's just the easiest success formula in life, isn't it? The more you do something, the better you're going to get at it. So I happened to do it because I enjoyed it and I loved it, but I never at that time thought about a career in professional sport, because there actually was no pathway for a blind person to be a sort of a professional athlete at that time. And I always remember my teachers, you know, and I've got the school report which says it, you know, if Darren spent as much time focusing in the classroom as he did on the football field, he might make something of his life. Now, I'm not going to criticize those teachers, because they didn't know any different, and nor did I. But ultimately what happened was, you know, I went and did the regular thing. I went to university, I did maths at uni, and then I got a sort of typical job in IT. I did that for a few years. But what I loved doing was training. I always did. And I still love training, even though I'm retired now. And so I was lucky enough to get spotted by one of the coaches and said, you know, would you like to come to an England training camp? And as soon as I went, I had my sort of metaphorical eye on someone in the team, and I thought, yeah, I'm having your place, mate. That's mine. And that's what I did. Just carried on training and just literally improving year on year on year. And, you know, I was lucky to be captain of the team. And then obviously then we had the sort of the point in Athens in 2004 when I thought I was going to fulfill my dream of going to the Paralympic Games for the first time. But obviously that didn't quite happen. But yeah, we had the whole politics, didn't we, of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland not sanctioning the Great Britain team. And so I had to make a decision about, you know, do I carry on with football and hope that we can change that decision around by the time Beijing came, or do I do something different? And I was lucky enough that I was a black belt in judo, because I loved fighting. But I knew that I couldn't get there just training, you know, a couple of times a week. We had this Russian judo coach at the time. And I remember this kid turned up to training once, and he said to this kid, he goes, how often do you do judo? And this kid goes, yeah, I go like twice a week. He goes, that is for fun. That is not for performance.
I mean, Darren, like, not to interrupt you there, but, you know, just that you met a barrier in playing for the British football team, so switched to your black belt judo activity. And I sense that I noticed in your TED talk, you're talking about resilience as a life skill and how important that is. But that competitive edge that I can hear in you there, that's a motivator, right? You know, that wanting to succeed is a big part of achievement, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, though, being blind in a certain way is taught resilience. And maybe lots of blind people haven't realised that they've got it within them, but you become very resourceful. I remember a situation at Worcester, when I was at Worcester College for the Blind, and there was these kids who had who'd lost. I still had a bit of sight then. So I remember these kids had lost the ball, and basically they just started rolling up and down the field. So they lay like head to toe, three or four of them, and they basically like, you know, scanned the field looking for this ball rolling up and down it, or they'd get a cricket bat or a stick or something and spin around in a big circle, you know, to cover more area. And it, sort of one element of it, I kind of thought that's really degrading, you know, having to do that. But the other side of it, I thought, you know what, they're resourceful and they'll find a way. And sometimes that's what you have to do in life, don't you? You have to find a way. It might not be the nicest way. It might not be the most enjoyable way. Yeah, we're all going to face obstacles, but you can find a way if you're prepared to be persistent, sometimes be humble and to get on with it.
There's something really powerful in what you say. I mean, the story that you tell there about the kids trying to find the ball, I think is inspirational from where I'm stood now. But when you said that thing, oh, maybe it's degrading. I think I remember personally when I was making the transition just from realizing I had to use a white cane. Mm. And there was a particular unfortunate incident where I went to jump over a fence to get more quickly to the pub to listen to a rugby game. And it was the wrong fence. I was somewhere different to where I thought I was. I was actually on the cliff fence and not on the park fence. And I thought, right, better use a white cane. And the barrier to me in there, honestly, which was, I think, personal, was about a sense that it in some way compromised my identity as a man. It sounds ridiculous saying it out now. Mm. You know, and I for me personally, I think the most profound considerations in that space came when my daughter got a diagnosis of this eye disease. And you know, for anything, you know, I've confronted in life as a parent with visual impairment, it was a game changer for me. To say that, to think about how I'm role modeling. And I wonder if you had any thoughts about that you'd like to share about, you know.
I think so. The first element of it is obviously when you know that you've got a heritable condition, that there is this sort of guilt in the essence of, like, you know, I know that, you know, there's a 50% chance of my children getting this condition, and I'm kind of almost willfully giving them that condition. So I had to kind of deal with that psychologically. But I suppose what helped me in the end was knowing that what better person to teach them how to cope with it if it did transgress. And also that certainly for my situation, I knew that there was a very good chance that they would be able to see, just because of the progress that's been made. I mean, I lost my sight basically because diagnosis was late. My retinoblastoma, which is cancer in both my eyes, was diagnosed at 15 months. And probably had it been three months later, I might not even be here to tell that story. But, you know, because I knew there was a chance that my son would get it, you know, he was diagnosed at 5 weeks. And so he was able to have his treatment so much earlier, when the cancer is not as big, the cancerous cells are not as big, and also that the treatment now is just a lot more precise. So, you know, I had radiotherapy, which is quite a blunt instrument, really, back in the 70s, and he had, you know, lasers only a few years ago. And so it's weird to think that actually we've got exactly the same eye condition, but completely different outcomes, because, you know, he can see perfectly well, probably won't even need glasses. So yeah, that's what progress is. Yet I'm still eternally grateful, because I remember I was going out to Ghana. Actually, I did a talk over there for a football academy, and there was a lady I know who's involved with a sight charity out in Africa. And she said, you know, could you visit one of the hospitals there? Because they've never met an RB survivor, because often in many third world countries, the diagnosis happens so late that it's already spread out of the eye into the body. And, you know, they don't live to tell the story. So, and that's still the case today. So that's just two kind of examples of, you know, how things have changed here over a period of time, but also that the challenge is still out there for so many other people across the world.
I mean, no greater testament than that story there about your son Darren and you know, the critical importance of the progress of the science around the treatment of eye disease. And as you say, the stakes with retinoblastoma are so high, and you know, we do our best here at Fight for Sight Vision Foundation to, you know, partner with cancer charities and, you know, look for those treatments. I wonder if you have any thoughts about the relationship between wanting science to progress and also wanting to live a free, independent and equitable life. I asked the question specifically because it's always struck me as slightly different to other, you know, charitable areas. There seems to be a huge separation in the sight loss charity world between, you know, living with sight loss and living with eye conditions and blindness and you know, interest in science. Whereas I know, you know, every generation of my family's gone blind, and I can bore everyone at length about stories of, you know, some of them managed to be butchers and various other things. But, you know, in my family, there's no separation between hoping one day it stops and wanting to live a free life. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Oh gosh, yeah, it's a really sort of emotive topic, you know. So, you know, retinoblastoma is one of the conditions that, you know, you can, you know, abort, I think, a fetus for. And that doesn't sit with me very comfortably, maybe now, especially as the treatment is so much better. But yeah, I think it's a really difficult. And, you know, when I'm involved in sort of the parents group as well, and when I see some of the stories of those parents, you know, when their child's just been diagnosed for the very first time, it's a really traumatic experience, more so for the parents probably than the children, because, you know, they're so young that they don't really know what's going on. But then eventually they will become parents and have to make those decisions themselves. So, you know, my conversation with my son at some point will be, you know, by the way, your eyes are normal, but you have got this defective RB1 gene in all of your body, which means A, you've got a 50% chance of passing on to your children, but also that you're at a high risk of second cancers. So I guess RB is probably unique because it touches two different areas. You know, it's not just about losing your sight, it's also about, you know, this rather life-threatening cancer that you can get. But in terms of the sight alone, yeah, I think there's no reason why you can't live a free and independent life as a blind person. I've been doing some mentoring actually of some blind kids in schools recently. It's some work that's kind of come out of the blue, really. But, you know, I was contacted by someone and she said, you know, I've got this student and we've tried everyone with him. He's had counsellors, he's had, you know, psychologists, he's had all sorts of different interventions and none of them have worked. You know, he says, you know, what could you do with him? And I said, okay, well, let's see, let's have a go. And one of the first things I say to any blind person now is that there's never been a better time to be blind. And I think it's such a profound statement, because actually, when you think back 200 years ago, and you read the story of Louis Braille and how Braille was invented, before that, blind children didn't even have an education. They didn't really go to school. There was no way for them to read and for them to write. You know, they were basically street entertainers or left to fend for themselves, you know, put in institutions. And so the progress in terms of the technology that we have now, you think back to 20 years ago before we had internet banking, where you had to get someone to read all your bank statements to you, all of your letters to you. I remember having a phone without any speech on it, you know, back in the day, and literally having to remember everybody's phone numbers, or Remembering
you're
these,
showing your age now, Darren. You
know? I know, literally
pre-iPhone generation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, now you can literally just say, you know, call such and such, and it does it. You know, you can, you know, there's this, and so that's the kind of progress that we've got, and the sort of sat nav sort of software is phenomenal, because it literally will take me to the door. Like, it will say this is 22, not 24. It has a few little blips, you know, like we moan now because we haven't got any internet coverage for a few seconds when it goes through a tunnel. And then we used to have these dial-up modems, so you had to wait ages, didn't you? Or someone picked up the phone and it cut off the connection. And I can sit on the bus. I remember being on a bus before and asking the driver to remind me to tell, you know, when I got to a particular stop. And a lot of the bus drivers don't know the routes. So they know the routes, but they don't necessarily know the names of the stops. Or sometimes they just forget. And so, you know, you're really at their mercy. But now I can just check where I am. I was on a train recently, actually, and this guy came up to me and said, "Excuse me, mate, how do you know what stop to get off?" And I said, "I listen to the announcements." And because a lot of sighted people don't even realize that the announcements
are, it's going on, yeah,
because it's not useful to them, it's not relevant to them. But I said, even if it didn't have announcements, I could check my sat nav on my phone, or I could, you know, ask the train manager to let me know, or I could ask another passenger. There were so many ways I can do things. And so when I say this to these kids in these schools, that there's never been a better time to be blind, I think it really shifts them out of this state. And perhaps a sighted person couldn't tell them that. Perhaps they feel that they wouldn't feel comfortable to tell them the truth that they need to hear. And, you know, I'm not saying that life's not going to be difficult for you. When you have a bit of reflection and think about, you know, how much more difficult it would have been 20, 50, 100 years ago, then, you know, you start from that position of gratitude and you can build on that.
I mean, as you say there, Darren, it's I think sight loss or you know, becoming blind or being born with blindness is it can be an incredibly individualizing experience. And one of the things that, I mean, I you'll forgive me, I stalked you a bit on YouTube. I've watched a number of things that you've got out there. And one of the things that struck me is, the two things that really struck me is, first of all, that you're talking to the community at large and not just the blind people in your business. And I really genuinely, it really started to shift my thinking listening to the way you were articulating that, because the things that we learn as human beings overcoming adversity are universally relevant to the population, and that's as true for blind people, I think, as it is of anyone else, those of us that make it. But then, and the other thing being that it's kind of important we find community with each other to link arms, I think. And well, this is me speaking now. I'm not saying you believe this. I mean, would you agree that finding community is also an important part of how we maintain our confidence and protect our mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've always been so one of the things that's really important to me is, you know, maintaining my health and my fitness. You know, partly because, you know, because I've got this sort of defective RB1 gene, and then that I'm at risk of second cancers, that, you know, part of cancer is lifestyle choice. And so I make those decisions to try and stay as fit and healthy as I can. And for me to do that requires other people, you know, unless I'm just going to get a treadmill and run in my garage, which was one option I considered, but I just, there's the social side to it. You know, and so when I go out and train with my group of runners and stuff, it's very much a social experience for us. You know, thankfully we're all quite fit, so we can run and talk at the same time. But also, you know, there's that, yeah, you're meeting people every day, you're hearing about them and their lives, and they're finding about you and your life, and there's that. But yeah, I need people to, you know, pick me up sometimes. You know, I'm working in there's been lots of train strikes, hasn't there, recently and stuff, and they're going to probably continue, I think, for the rest of the year, and so there are times when I can't even get from A to B because of a train strike, and so I'm having to sort of tap into my network and say, you know, is anyone free? Can that they can drive me from A to B? Can someone help me with this? Can someone help me with that? We can't do everything ourselves. And as great as the technology is, it still doesn't do everything. And so having this community around you. But the thing that I mentioned it in my TED talk was around sort of it not being this hierarchical relationship in terms of help. So often people don't ask for help because they don't want to be perceived as helpless, a victim. But it becomes cyclical, doesn't it? You know, you help, you know, like the old days, actually, when, you know, you didn't have a bag of sugar and they didn't have any salt and you kind of did this exchange, didn't you? You know, and I think it's a little bit like that now where there are things that I can help people with, but there's things that they can help me with. And then so, you know, you're not always this victim. And also if someone helps you and then, you know, you're then able to elevate yourself and lift yourself, then you're now in a position to go and help others. And so, yeah, absolutely. And I know you talked about that process of losing your sight. So that is probably the hardest transition, the bit when you've still got a little bit of sight and you know, because I remember it well, I remember being able to go around the shop and I could probably do it myself. But it would take me not even twice as long, probably three or four times as long to do it, you know. And I remember sort of standing, kind of peering at the stuff on the shelves trying to find it. Now they've got Braille on half the stuff in the shop, so I could probably just feel it. But back then, you know, and there'd be like a queue of people kind of, because I'm getting in their way. And it was just really, really difficult. You know, yeah, I could have gone up to someone and asked for help. But at that point in my life, I didn't really want to accept that I was going blind. I didn't want to accept people's help. I didn't really want people to know I was blind. So I always used to say I'd prefer people to think I was drunk than blind, you know. So when I walked into someone, I'd probably think, oh, he's just drunk, and like, you know, as opposed to, oh, that poor blind person sort of thing. And so that was definitely the most challenging time, you know, that period when I was losing it. But kind of once it was all gone, it was like, okay. It's gone now.
Yeah, it's so really, really familiar with that. And that whole bumping into people thing, that was one of the reasons from my point of view of being having an identifier. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the cane is an identifier. You mentioned that earlier about canes and, you know, dogs. And I just do not think about it at all anymore. It's part of how I'm mobile and getting on with my life. Whereas at first, I was motivated to do it because of the risk I created to myself of like jumping over a fence with a 30-foot drop on the other side, which fortunately I stopped halfway through. And also, like you say, what, you know, if you go to, I mean, young enough then to be going to pubs and clubs and, you know, you bump into people and there's no visible sign, you know, immediately you can end up in, you know, these silly events are. I have to say though, that you know, I think my transition is pretty much summed up by the fact that nothing makes me happier now than in an area where I know where I'm going, somebody asking me directions. I actually get a real buzz out of that, because I don't know if you find this, but you know, when you're having to navigate, I mean, previously by white cane, now with a dog, you've got to know every nook and cranny of where you are to make sure you get to the right place. And there's quite a privilege in somebody saying, oh, do you know how to get, especially if they're sighted, you know.
It is beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. There's this kind of bewilderment you can hear in their voice. Like,
yeah.
How does he know that? Or when I'm in the car with someone, I'm saying, you know, just go left here and then go
left right. Yeah.
And they can't understand how you know, but it's because when I played football, you learn to use every cue that there is in the environment, you know, whether it's the direction of the wind, whether it's the feel of the sun, whether there's a slope. So, you know, we can feel a roundabout, we can feel a hill that the car goes down, we can feel, you know, when you come to a roundabout. And so All of those things give me little cues of where I am, and I'm able to use all that information and sort of, yeah. So they don't do it because they just look out the window and, you know, they see a supermarket, that's their landmark. They see a church, that's their landmark, you know. And we've got landmarks too, they're just different. And because they're not tuned into our world, like, you know, they just can't think the way we think, but that's how it is. And so it's super cool, you know. I remember probably one of the first really eye-opening moments for me was at Worcester when there was literally a totally blind guy riding a bike, and it just blew my mind. It's like, how is he riding this bike? And he's weaving in and out of obstacles. And, you know, I didn't know anything about echolocation. I'd never heard of the term. In fact, you know, we didn't talk about it back then, and that's what it is. But yeah, it just blew my mind. And it was like, wow, this is like a real life daredevil. He's here. So yeah, they do, and we can do some incredible things.
And it does look like magic sometimes, particularly when you first see someone do something. It's quite an exhilarating experience. Darren, we're nearly at the end of our time here. Absolutely just wonderful to hear your voice, and I really look forward to speaking to you in the future. I wonder if you could just say a few words about what you're looking forward to with Unblind Your Mind in the year ahead.
Yeah, so I think for me, it's, you know, one of the things you talked about was that, you know, that I work, you know, across sectors. And I think because blindness is such a visible disability, people can close their eyes and imagine that's what my life would be like. But actually it's not, because I've had years to adapt and grow to my situation. And so I suppose what I try and use it to do is to serve as inspiration to everybody that, you know, that we can all change over time. And just because I've got something that's visible, you know, there's other people, you know, we talked about mental health earlier, there's other people with less visible challenges, but they're challenges nonetheless. But with the right mindset, I think, and with the right support, I don't think there's much that we can't accomplish.
Darren Harris, England footballer, black belt judo player, and absolutely brilliant public speaker. It's been a joy to spend some time with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Keith.